I'd like to encourage you to turn in your Old Testaments to the book of Genesis in the first chapter, Genesis chapter 1. There were some that were wondering if there was a handout with the lesson this evening, and I think this may be the first time I have not used the television screen behind me with regard to a lesson since we've gotten this, but I almost feel compelled on occasion to turn it off. I don't want to get too dependent upon it. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time looking this evening at a series of passages, most of them found in the book of Genesis. We're going to be discussing the concept of life, the call that God gives us to respect life and the sanctity of life. I think it's an interesting and certainly a germane subject given the different views that are held and the applications that can be made in our society today. And I thought it might be good for us to begin in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26 and go down through the end of the chapter and note the creation of man and man's place in God's creation as related in this particular text. God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves on the earth." Then God said, verse 29, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food." And it was so. Well, notice that there was a vegetarian diet here in the Garden of Eden. We're told in verse 31 that God saw everything that he had made. Indeed, it was very good, and the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Now, the first thing I want to know, because when we talk about the concept of life, that is inclusive of vegetation. Vegetation is living, as well as I think it's the fauna, flora and fauna, so having reference to animals. The animals are living creatures as well. And here in the beginning, you'll note, God created man in his image. And that is, I think, a very important point to make, that we are made in the image of God. And as such, we are different from the animals. Now, we're going to emphasize that in just a few moments. But in the beginning, God gave man a diet of vegetables. And also, not only man, but as indicated in the text, to every beast of the air, every bird of the air, and everything that creeps on the earth as well. The herbs were given as food. And this, as far as we can tell, persisted through the entirety of the existence of mankind up until the flood. I want you to go in your Old Testaments over now to Genesis, the ninth chapter. Genesis chapter 9. And we will just note the fact that in the interim between chapters 1 and chapters 9, God had judged the earth and destroyed all of the living creatures save those that were on the ark. And we find that God destroyed mankind except for Noah and for those souls that are on the ark with him. Then at the end of this deliverance, when the waters receded and the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat, we're told that Noah built an altar to the Lord in verse 20. And he made a burnt offering to the Lord. So here we find a burnt offering that is made. Now I want you to notice, continuing on into chapter 9. Now again, when we say with regard to the killing of animals, and this is the first point that we're going to make in our lesson, I do want to note that that did happen prior to this time here in Genesis chapter 9. We find as an example that Abel offered one of the fruit of his flock as an offering to God. God had respect for Abel's offering. You'll remember that God did not have respect for the offering of Cain, which was the fruit of harvest that Cain had to offer. Now, with regard to that, I would assume that that was an animal sacrifice on that particular occasion. But again, the first indication that we have concerning a change in diet for man and the killing of animals to eat is found here in Genesis chapter 9. If you'll note with me, beginning in the first four verses of Genesis chapter 9, that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and all that move on the earth, and all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand." Now the language is a bit different than what we found in Genesis chapter 1, where man has given dominion over the animals and was to subdue. Here we are told that these have been given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. So that is inclusive not only of vegetation, but now also meat. He said, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs, but you shall not eat flesh with its life." That is, its blood. And so with regard to this, this allowance made by God for the killing of animals in order to eat meat, there was a prohibition that was placed here. And that is, you shall not eat the life with it. That is, the blood. And so there is a prohibition against eating blood. As far as I understand, as you look throughout Scripture, there has never been a repealing of that prohibition against the eating of blood. Now, I know that there are certain cultures in which the eating of blood is something that is allowed. But there is no indication that I can see from Scripture where that prohibition was repealed. In fact, you may remember Jerusalem Council in Acts the 15th chapter, while God refused to require of the Gentile that he keep certain aspects of the law of Moses, there were certain things that as a Christian were required of the Gentiles as well, and among those, abstaining from the eating of blood. And so that prohibition seems to remain. And I think that there may be something about the concept of the respect for the sanctity of life that is found in that. That you shall not eat the life with the food or with the meat. That is, of the blood. And so what I do want us to understand and acknowledge, I think it's something that is a familiar concept to those of us who are seeking to live righteously, that the abuse of animals, just for the purpose of, whether it be for the purpose of sport or because of a sociopathic tendency that any individual might have, is something that is indicative of an unrighteous individual, an unrighteous person. And so while it is right and proper for us to subdue, it is right and proper for us, as God has given all flesh into our hand for us, to kill it and to eat it, as indicated in this particular text, there is a call for man, even with respect to the life of animals, to be just. I'll give you a couple of passages which I think will enlighten us a bit on this. The first one is in Exodus, the 23rd chapter, in verses 4 and 5. And this, again, are a series of instructions that God gives with regard to the Israelites, with regard to just action, specifically toward one another. This is what defines an individual as being a just or a good person. And among those things that were given in that list, in that 23rd chapter, you'll notice in verses 4 and 5, "If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again." You'll notice this is your enemy. Now that, of course, is indicative of a respect for your enemy, that is, for him, the human who owns these animals. But in addition to that, if you'll notice in verse 5, the statement that if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden. Now that's an indication of an animal that's in distress. Not a donkey who is bearing up under its burden, but has been overtaken or overcome by his burden, and he's lying under its burden. He said, if you refrain, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. And so there is a responsibility again there, which is indicative, again, of the type of compassion that we even ought to show for animals who, after all, are living creatures. When we look at that particular circumstance, we can look back in the history of man and see all types of examples to where this concept of caring for animals has been completely and totally disregarded. There have been a number of things that have happened in our history in America. For example, Near extinction of the American bison or the buffalo as a result of the practices back in the 19th century. We can talk about the practice that is common today with regard to whaling and the purposes and uses. Not like the Eskimos who will kill a whale and use every aspect of it, but rather the wholesale slaughter, the killing of baby seals. These are the kinds of things that we're talking about, where individuals, for example, with regard to the tusks of elephants, because they are considered of great value, it is not uncommon for poachers to kill elephants and just leave the carcass to basically rot, because the only thing that they were interested in is the tusk, and that's the reason why they killed that creature. That kind of action is an indication of an unjust individual. Actions of an unjust individual. There's another passage in Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 10 which says that a righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. So there is a distinction again between an individual who might act rightly and is tending and being a superintendent or a steward of the creation that God has given him, subduing it as it has been given into his hand by God, and one that is indeed mistreating others. And again, you might look just as an example, one of the characteristics of the sociopath has been identified. We talk about, for example, serial killers, individuals who take life, who have been defined by their responses as sociopaths. One of the common beginnings of their sociopathic and psychopathic activities was the torture of small animals. And this is an indication of inappropriate views and attitudes toward towards God's creation. Now, having said that and stipulating that those things are so, as we alluded to at the beginning of our study in Genesis chapter 1, there is a very real and large difference between animals and men. It's just the way it is. And again, in our culture, there are many people that are unwilling to recognize that. They do not see that distinction. But God has established a very real difference between human beings and animals. And you can look in this same text in Genesis chapter 9 and find that very clearly stated, where in the four verses of the text, we are told that God gave to Noah and his descendants, that is us, all flesh, having reference to animal flesh as food. We are told in verse 5, surely for your lifeblood, that is the lifeblood of Noah and his companions, the lifeblood of man, he said, for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. In other words, there is no reckoning if the blood of an animal is shed for the purpose of taking food and sustaining oneself. But he says, for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. So, again, with regard to the sanctity of life and respecting the sanctity of human life, it's an interesting thing. He says man may take the life of an animal for food. And there is no, again, no limitation. Now, I do understand there are some dietary restrictions that were found under the law of Moses. They had a very specific purpose in teaching the Israelites the holiness of God. But in this particular passage, which predates the Mosaic law, there was no limitation given here. Every beast is given to you as food. You can take the life of these animals. But what happens if an animal takes the life of a man? If an animal takes the life of a man, he said, there is a reckoning that is demanded. From the hand of every beast, I will require it. That has reference to the blood of the beast. That is, if an animal takes the life of a human, as a respect for the sanctity of human life, that animal's life must be taken in answer or as a reckoning for the loss of human life. Not only with regard to the animal, but because of the nature of life and the importance of respecting the sanctity of life, this is not only a reckoning that would be required of animals if they take the life of a man, but he says, from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For, and this is why, in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. So a very clear statement that if human life is taken, that there will be the taking of life as reckoning. Now this is what we refer to in our day and time as capital punishment. And again, the reason for this is because God requires that human life to be respected. And as reason for that, there is the requirement of life for life if human life is taken in an unjust manner. Now, again, when you look at the Old Testament, you find, for example, under the covenant of Moses, there were exceptions in regard to this. That is, if a life was taken premeditated, that is, it was in fact what we would define as murder, then there would be blood for blood, life for life. However, if the life that was taken accidentally, then there were cities of refuge to which the guilty party could flee so that his life would not be taken. So even under the law of Moses, there were distinctions between the premeditated murder of an individual, accidental taking of human life, and then even, as we've alluded to in this particular text, life that is taken in punishment for a murder that has been committed. And so when we look at passages such as Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 17, where we find that first statement concerning God's 10 commandments under that law of Moses, the commandment, you shall not murder. Now you might go back to the King James Version, which says you shall not kill. The New King James renders it, you shall not murder. But there is a distinction or a difference between what we might refer to as the unlawful taking of human life and the lawful taking of human life. Now when we look at murder, the first example that we have of that is when Cain killed Abel. Interestingly, I read just this afternoon as I was boning up to the material and looking over this material for this evening, I read an article which noted that actually the murder of Abel by Cain was actually the second murder that was alluded to in the book of Genesis. You'll remember in that the devil deceived Eve and she ate of the forbidden fruit. As a result of that, God had said, "The day you eat of it, you shall surely die." You may remember Jesus, in alluding to the devil, calls him a murderer, and he was a murderer from the beginning. And so Satan himself was responsible with regard to the loss of human life from the very beginning. But with regard to that, the first example in Genesis chapter 4 was when Cain killed Abel as he was angry at his brother and jealous for the fact that God had received Abel's offering. In verse 10 of Genesis chapter 4, we are told that God said to Cain, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And when you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth." Now, on this particular occasion, with regard to the taking of life, God did not institute the life for life requirement that came later after the flood in Genesis, the ninth chapter. However, having established that in Exodus chapter 21 and verse 14, with regard to the requirements under that old law, we are told that if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. So this was a requirement. Now, that gets us into another question with regard to this requirement of life for life. And I understand, recognize, that it is not something that is always practiced in every society. In fact, it is common, at least in Western Europe, that there is no such thing as a death penalty. It is also, as we alluded to in our Bible study this morning in studying Romans chapter 13, the fact that the capital punishment is not practiced in all of the states in the United States as it is in the state of Texas and numerous others. And so it is not always the case that life is given, because men do not always follow God's commandments in regard to these things. We're not surprised at that. But what we want to emphasize is not only the right, but again the responsibility for the civil authorities to exercise themselves in this regard so that life will be respected. The sanctity of life will be understood. And so in Romans chapter 13 and verse 4 of the text, we are told concerning the governing authority that he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister. So here we find that he is God's servant for good if you do good. So what does that mean? That means, first of all, with regard to the civil government and those authorities, their purpose in existing is to protect individuals who act in lawful and righteous ways. So if you are a law-abiding citizen, you are respecting the laws of the land, you're respecting the laws of God. As a result of that, the civil authorities serve as God's minister to protect you as a result of your obedience to those laws. But if you do evil, he says, be afraid, because he is also God's minister as an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Is indicated this. And again, as we have alluded to in our study this morning, in that latter phrase, he does not bear the sword in vain, we understand in that euphemism that certainly inclusive in this idea of civil authorities as being a minister to avenge and execute wrath on the evildoer, that is inclusive of the sword or even the execution of one who has taken unlawfully a human life. Now, all of this teaches the respect for the sanctity of life. And I understand that there are individuals in our society today that will say, well, if you practice the death penalty, you're killing. But again, understand this. It is not I that am killing. Even if I am an individual who is working as an employee of the government, working as an agent of the government, it is the government that has been appointed by God who is in that position. He is in that position for the express purpose of engendering in the citizens that respect for the sanctity of life. And indeed, it is something that does indicate that very clearly. If the ultimate penalty must be paid if life is taken, that life is shown to be extremely sacred, extremely important, extremely valuable. If I unlawfully take the life of another, I know that in so doing, it will be necessary that I forfeit my own life. There is something to be said for the value of that innocent life that I may take. And that's the way God looks at it. And I understand that men may disagree with that. Men may consider that we are barbaric in that we would condone the practice of capital punishment. But what God has said very clearly in Scripture is that is as a result of how precious and valuable human life truly is. So much so that if that human life is taken by an animal, the animal must be killed. But if that human life is taken by another man, that man's life is forfeit as well. And so that's what God has to say with regard to the sanctity of human life. Now, there are many applications that could be made. We made an allusion to capital punishment. But there are a couple of others that I want to make note of, and this is perhaps the reason why I wanted to identify this and explain it as I have. And that is with regard to the common practice in our culture, in our society, of abortion. And so we ask that question with regard to what is human life. And there are individuals who would want to equivocate, perhaps muddy the water, with regard to what is human life. The question is, and I actually was reading an article to where a question was asked of one of the political candidates concerning whether or not they believe that life begins at conception. And the answer was that they certainly believe that the potential for life begins at conception. Now, what does that mean? The potential for life. That what is conceived in the fertilization of an egg by sperm, that's not alive, but it has the potential for life? Well, explain it then. Explain how there can be multiple cells that are divided, how that there can be growth and how there can be development if what is there is not alive, but only has the potential of life. Because we don't define that in any way, in any other situation, in any other circumstance. You talk about someone who is shedding their skin. You say, well, what is being shed when the shed is being said? Well, that's the dead skin cells. Those cells are no longer alive. And so because they have died, they have detached from the epidermis. And as a result of that, they slough off because they are dead cells. They're not alive. We understand that if any aspect of your body, anything is cut off from the body and is deprived of that blood source, that as a result of that, that thing, whatever it may be, a finger, an ear, a nose, or whatever, that will die as a result of that, as it's cut off. John 15, with regard to the vine and the branches, that same basic principle is being established. So if we understand and acknowledge that because those are cells and they are alive, what kind of life is it, is the question. What kind of life is it? And as we understand and acknowledge that when a human egg is fertilized by human sperm, that what comes as a product of that is a human baby, then we recognize, number one, it's both alive, and number two, it's human life that we have at the point of conception. Now, again, there are individuals who want to equivocate with regard to that. Understand, however, that in our common society, as we look at it today, since 1973, when the Roe v. Wade decision, the U.S. Supreme Court, legalized abortion under certain circumstances, and that, of course, has changed to the point and developed to the point to where abortion is legal in all three trimesters up until the birth of an unborn child, regardless of the rarity of a third trimester abortion, the fact is it is legal in the United States of America by federal law. Understand this, that these definitions and these equivocations and these peculiar usage of terms such as fetus and an unwillingness to acknowledge that that which is in the womb is a baby is as a result of merely desiring to keep the practice that we want to keep. And I can prove that. I want to give you a couple of quotes. Again, with regard to important public figures, the first one is our president, Barack Obama. I put this in the bulletin a number of times ago, which is why it came to my mind in discussing this. Now, this was not when he was serving as president. It has not been within the last 8 years. It was actually while he was a state senator in Illinois. Now, as a state senator in Illinois, they were arguing on the floor of the state legislature whether or not to pass a law that would identify a fetus as a person. We want to define, by law, a fetus as a person. And Barack Obama opposed that. And the reason why, these are his words. He said, whenever we define a pre-viable fetus as a person that is protected by the Equal Protection Clause or the other elements in the Constitution, what we're really saying is, in fact, that they are persons that are entitled to the kinds of protections that would be provided to a child, a nine-month-old, a child that was delivered to term. That determination then, essentially, if it was accepted by a court, would forbid abortions to take place. It would essentially ban abortions because the Equal Protection Clause does not allow somebody to kill a child. And if this is a child, then this would be an anti-abortion statute, and that's why he opposed it. I want you to think about that a moment, because what I want to talk about when we discuss this concept of the sanctity of human life, the presumptuousness of some individuals to think that we have a right to define what is human, that we have the right to determine or to decide who is a person. The interesting thing, and the second quote that I want to, is a very short one, is a quote that Hillary Clinton made just recently with regard to abortion rights. Most of you are familiar with the fact that she is an advocate for abortion rights and opposes any limitations with regard to abortion throughout the three trimesters. And this is a very simple quote from her. The unborn person, she says, does not have any constitutional rights. Now, the interesting thing about this, and this got her in hot water when she made this quote with regard to those who are pro-abortionists, because they said, how dare you use the term person? We don't want to use that term person. But she said person. Not only did she say person, she went on to say that while she was for abortion and recognize that an unborn person does not have the right, she said, that doesn't mean that I do not want the child to receive care if the mother wants to keep that child until term. So not only did she use the term person, she used the term child to describe the unborn fetus in the womb. And boy, she got in hot water. Not only did she get in hot water to those people who are pro-life because she's saying that this is a person, but that person does not have any constitutional rights. That equal protection clause under the Constitution, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't apply to that child because that child is not yet born. She also got in trouble with regard to the pro-abortion camp because she said person, she said child. But I want you to consider how presumptuous it is for us to say that we as a people, based upon a document that was signed 200 plus years ago, and based upon the decisions that we make as a constitutional republic, we determine that an unborn child does not have the right to life unless we deem that that child can live. Or, more precisely, that child does not have the right to live unless the mother says that that child can live. How presumptuous that is. And it's not until that child passes through the birth canal and takes that first breath, that child constitutionally has the protection for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How presumptuous and arrogant we are to arbitrarily require viability. Again, I'll go back to that quote with regard to Barack Obama. He says, whenever we define a pre-viable fetus. Now, that was a while ago, and viability has changed since he said this. And viability is not something that you hear about anymore. It was in 1973. In fact, the reason why they said that abortion could be unlimited up to a period of weeks, and then from that point in time, it was possible for law to place restrictions because they were counting on that concept of viability. And in 1973, when the court was asking medical experts, when does a fetus become viable? It was very different then than it is now with all of the progress that we have made with regard to medicine and the ability to keep babies alive who are born prematurely. And so that concept of viability has changed. But why in the world is the concept of viability even in the picture? Why is it a part of the question? Why is it if we say that that child cannot exist on its own, that it cannot exist outside of the womb, that it cannot exist without the help or the support of the mother, that because that is the case, it has no right to life and it has no right to protection? Is that not arrogant on our part, presumptuous on our part, and a disrespect for and disregarding of the sanctity of human life? And by the way, just as a note before we draw this lesson to a close, I want you to consider the fact that viability works both directions, doesn't it? We got two problems with regard to the way secular society deals with this concept of life. We have established very clearly what God says life is and how we are to respect life. But when individuals begin to say, I have the right, or we as a culture, we as a nation have the right to, one, define who is human, and to define whether or not viability makes a difference with regard to the value and the sustainability of human life, then we're going down a rabbit's hole that has no end. You see, whenever we talk about this, invariably, a parallel rises up in our minds. When we see such things being said, we think Nazi Germany, don't we? We think the Holocaust. We think the fact that the Nazi German party basically determined to define who is human differently than what we would. We think that's atrocious, and that is appalling. And so if such a parallel is brought up and we discuss this, then we automatically are castigated for having the audacity to compare people who are pro-abortion with the Nazis. How dare you do such a thing? But there is a parallel that exists there. I want you to acknowledge and understand that there is a parallel that exists there. We don't have the right as men to define who is human. We don't have the right to define personhood. God is the one who has determined and defined that, not us. And what is to stop a culture, just as Nazi Germany did, never happened here? Perhaps. But if someone claims it would never happen in the United States of America, that any group based upon race, based upon culture, based upon gender, whatever the case may be, no way that it would ever happen here that anyone would exclude any individual from the definition of personhood so that they can be done away with, I would assert to you that's exactly what they have done with the unborn child. Exactly. And so we explain away personhood, then we can with impunity kill the child. And that is commonly practiced. And when that happens, and especially when this concept of viability comes in, now you have individuals coming out of the woodwork who say, wait a second. There are others who are burdens upon our society. You realize that the reason why abortion is practiced is because an unborn child is a burden? That's the explanation that is given. In 1973, it was that an abortion can take place to protect the health of the mother. If having that child puts a medical burden upon the woman, then she has the right to abort that child. But that's the reason why abortion can take place. Now, abortion on demand has become the norm. Why? Because that has been broadly defined as a medical burden. Could be something that is impactful not only of a person's physical health or safety, but their mental and social health as well. So if in fact it reaches the point where the child is unwanted, the child is construed as being a burden to the mother. And again, I do not want to castigate women in general. That's what society has determined, that the mother is the sole arbiter in regard to this, that it's a question between a woman and her caregiver. That if a woman considers a child a burden for any reason, that in and of itself is just cause to rid that child, to kill that child. So what about the elderly among us? It is no longer viable for them. And it may be that they have a chronic illness. It may be that they have a illness that will eventually kill them. A terminal illness. It may be as a result of the fact that the family just does not have the wherewithal to maintain them in this place where they are. Is it not a burden on society? And if it is a burden on society, should not society have the right to say their living is no longer viable, we have the right to kill them? How heinous and horrible that sounds. Well, no, not really. I mean, it is, yes. But that's what euthanasia is. Mercy, killing. And oh, we're doing it for the person. But understand, it is a question of viability. And if that question, it is decided that their life is no longer of value, that their life is no longer viable, then we are being merciful if we euthanize that person. Jack Kevorkian, everyone knows Dr. Kevorkian. He says, this is a quote from him, "We need euthanasia. We need euthanasia for certain cases where people are in comas or too immobile to even press a button. Because they can't kill themselves, we need to be able to kill them in certain cases." And there are societies and there are people who believe and teach that it's time for us to get a hold on this because it's such a burden on society. We need to be able as a society to pass laws to where the legislature defines and the Supreme Court upholds these laws so that we can say if a person reaches a particular state, that we have the right to take their life. Now, I don't know if it'll ever get there. I don't know if that's the case at all. But it's happening on the other end of the spectrum. And it shows a lack of respect for society in our culture. I want to leave you with a passage from Isaiah chapter 59. Along these lines in verses 6 through 8. Isaiah 59 and verses 6 through 8. Concerning the ungodliness of Israel. The definition of their ungodliness or description of their ungodliness starts in verse 6. Goes down through verse 8. It actually covers much more than just that. But those are the verses we want to read. Beginning in verse 6, their webs will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity. And the act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed innocent blood. And their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths, and whoever takes that way shall not know peace. And I would say to you that there are many, many problems with our society today. The depth of depravity and immorality that we see, it's appalling. And it is alarming. I want you to understand this thing. That as the violence and the haste to shed innocent blood brought the stricture and condemnation of God upon Israel, we cannot long continue as a nation if the shedding of innocent blood continues. It doesn't matter who the innocent blood is. It doesn't matter if it's a minority or a majority. It doesn't matter if it's a young person or an old person. It doesn't matter if it is the born or is the unborn. If we do not have compassion as a society, then God will one day judge us for our ungodliness. And so what that does that leave us to? Well, as Christians, it leaves us with that responsibility ourselves to respect human life. It calls upon us to respect animal life as well, as we alluded to at the beginning of our lesson. To be just and righteous in our actions. To strive to the very best of our ability to impact and influence our culture. The best way to do that is through the proclamation of truth. To change people's minds about such ungodliness and turn them away from such sin that we may receive God's blessings rather than His censure. It's a very important thing for us to consider. And when we talk about decisions made in our political reality today, it's kind of interesting. I was watching one particular program and they were talking about what's going to make the difference in this election, and people were talking about, well, you know, there is that concern about foreign affairs, and specifically with regard to the protection and safety of our nation and our national interest. And they said, but ultimately in the end, it all revolves around the pocketbook. The elections are won and lost with regard to the economy. If things are going good enough, and enough people are happy with the way their pocketbook is, then they're going to vote for the incumbent. If people are upset, enough of them are upset because they don't have enough money or things are too hard for them, they're going to vote for the challenger. And ultimately, most of these other things seldom have any impact at all in the decisions that we make as a country. And if that is the case, then shame upon us as a people. Because if we're willing to set aside and not think about those things and consider those things that have reference to sin against God, those things that have reference to ungodliness and inform, and in all aspects of life, not just with regard to voting, because that's really just a tangential thing, but with regard to every aspect of our life, if what animates us and what motivates us and what impels us as we live day by day is not to ensure that we are being righteous as God defines the term, then we're in bad shape. And there is real danger to be found, both as a nation and with us individually. And so there is that call for us to proclaim the gospel message, to try to convince the world concerning things such as righteousness and temperance. And in the reasoning of those things, the eventuality of eternity, so that their soul might be saved as they turn from their sin. Going to offer an invitation at this time, and it may be that something we talked about this evening has touched your heart, leading you to recognize your responsibility to turn to God. And if that is the case, we offer you the opportunity to do that this evening. If as a child of God there is something that is amiss in your life, you want to make that right, the invitation is extended to you as well. We can help you in any way to answer that call. We ask that you come. Well, together we stand while we sing.